Taylor Lorenz is a journalist covering the content creator world and a tech columnist for the Washington Post. She has previously worked for the New York Times, The Atlantic, and The Daily Beast. Her writing has appeared in New York Magazine, Rolling Stone, Fast Company, and she regularly appears on NBC, CNN, MSNBC, and the BBC. Taylor was named to Fortune's 40 Under 40 list of leaders in media and entertainment in 2020. Adweek included her in their Young Influentials Who Are Shaping Media, Marketing, and Tech listing. Town and Country magazine, I like this one, named her to their New Creative Vanguards list, calling her the Bob Woodward of the TikTok generation. She lives in Los Angeles and is currently beefing with Elon Musk on Twitter or X or whatever they are calling it today. More importantly, she is the author of the upcoming book Extremely Online, The Untold Story of Fame, Influence, and Power on the Internet, which comes out October 3rd. What better way to add to that impressive list of accomplishments than an appearance on Chad and Steve Have a Podcast? So please join me in welcoming Taylor Lorenz.
Thank you so much for having me.
So have you been Xing? Is that what we're calling it now? Xing?
That's what he wants us to call it. But he still hasn't changed the button on the website from tweet. So
he can't even get the word Twitter off of his building without causing controversy right now, it seems. And you know what? Let's actually shelve Elon Musk because he does not deserve our attention. I would much rather learn more about you. And could you just rewind all the way to back? Like, what was your first exposure to social media kind of in general?
Yeah, well, I mean, I never had a MySpace. I'm a millennial, despite what, it's funny that Town and Country call me part of the TikTok generation, because I would say that's more Gen Z. I'm definitely a millennial, but I am addicted to TikTok and post a lot on there. I wasn't that online as a kid. I didn't really get, I had Facebook in college and stuff, obviously, but I didn't really get hyper online until Tumblr. In 2009, right after college, I had worked sort of temp jobs and retail jobs for a couple of years. And then I discovered Tumblr, which changed my life. And I got obsessed and addicted and I started blogging. And Tumblr was kind of my gateway to the broader social internet. That's the reason I signed up for Twitter, was to just follow people that I loved on Tumblr. And
do you remember what it was about Tumblr that was different or just that really resonated with you?
I just felt there were all these really cool, creative, interesting people that I had never been exposed to before. My world was very I was living in New York City. I wasn't exactly sheltered, but I just, there were so many interesting people with new perspectives. And I felt it was such a breath of fresh air to traditional media. I felt this is back when I was a young millennial, the traditional media really didn't speak to millennials. And there were whole digital media companies sort of founded on this philosophy. But, they would write about the internet specifically in this really stupid way where it was condescending, or it was talking about it as this niche other world. And I was no, it's not another world and it's the real world. And the internet is our default reality. It's really important. And the way that they're dismissive of it made me really mad. And they were also really dismissive of content creators. And as somebody that was a blogger myself and spent time online, just made me really resentful of the media, because I was actually bloggers are doing real work. YouTubers are doing real work. And we should cover that, industry of content creators as work and labor and an actual creative industry. When at that time too, especially in the early 20s, there was obsession with selfies. Remember how it was so controversial to take a selfie? Oh, people were so mad at but this notion of putting yourself in front of the camera and kind of taking up space online really made people mad. And I always thought it was cool, so I just started writing about all that stuff.
Do you think mainstream media, though, is kind of getting more up to speed with this and those attitudes have changed? And do you think that your attitude has changed now that you're kind of part of that mainstream media?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, they've definitely changed a little bit. I wish that they would actually get their shit together. I think they're it's funny in 2023, finally we should pay attention to this stuff. Even the way that they write about it, though, it's at least now they're writing about it. And at least now they're covering what's going on online. They're just covering it in a very dumb and sort of watered down way. There's not real analysis or understanding of the internet. It's more of a like, it's still sort of this like bird's eye view, like, let me explain this TikTok trend, or like, I interviewed, you know, this TikToker who's going viral, which like, I love those stories. I read them all the time, but I'd love to see the mainstream media go a little bit deeper and actually do some of the stuff that, for instance, people on YouTube are doing. I'm a big fan of this guy, CoffeeZilla, on YouTube and his investigations. And I think it's pretty telling that, you know, he is the one that like took on a lot of the crypto industry. I mean, there was some good, great crypto reporting, but someone like that, you know, like he's very much a journalist and doing his stuff on YouTube. I'd love to see more of that from traditional media.
Do you think that that's happening on YouTube because YouTube's putting itself or positioning itself to become that platform, which, because that's what appealed to both me and Steve, and we talk about that on this podcast endlessly, about how in the early days it was about doing it because this was the uncharted territory and this was different. Broadcast yourself. And as much as it's come full circle, out of all of the quote unquote social media platforms, YouTube seems to have the best organic, like, seems like Will Smith's trying to run over and Steve-O are trying to kind of like get over onto this side. And do you see that, like, perhaps YouTube is a good example of a platform which is enabling that?
Definitely. I mean, I think that's not to say that all, like, you know, I think journalism on YouTube gets a bad rep because there's so many like commentary channels that kind of like take on the air of journalism and almost act like they're doing investigations, but they're really just doing sort of drama, you know, like exposing so-and-so. They're definitely not doing actual reporting, but I think there's just so much great analysis and thoughtful content and just really interesting stuff that you're not going to see in the mainstream media on the internet. And that's something that I've always loved, whether it's Tumblr or YouTube or any of these other platforms. Like, you're not just getting sort of the official like New York Times narrative, you're also getting critiques of things like that, or you're hearing from people who are actually in the communities that are being reported on. And obviously, again, misinformation is a huge problem online. I'm not trying to say that it's not, but I've always, I think, coming from sort of from the internet, valued that and wish that the traditional media could sort of adapt a little bit better to operating in those areas.
And as somebody who's keyed into the younger generation and Gen Z, do they still see YouTube as that alternative source? Or is it, because YouTube is up, you know, what, 20 years old at this point, almost approaching 20 years. Or is it starting to look like that's become the mainstream? And so, like, well, this is why the kids are on TikTok and whatever else might be happening.
I think TikTok definitely put YouTube on notice, and a lot of young people, like the sort of the use cases that millennials had for YouTube, you know, Gen Z goes to TikTok over YouTube. I think also just TikTok's discovery mechanism is just so much better. Like, it's so hard to grow on YouTube, as we all know. Like, it's a different ecosystem. You have to, it's just a very different platform structurally than an app like TikTok, which prioritizes short form video. So, you know, I think TikTok is a default, but look, everyone on TikTok is trying to get on YouTube. Like, YouTube is still the gold standard for monetization.
Well, at some point they want to make some money.
Yeah. Exactly.
But do you think a lot of kids, they're perfectly happy to be paid in followers?
Yeah. I mean, what I would say is that followers are a valuable form of currency. I mean, I think that obviously money is sort of more valuable in some ways, but having a following can get you money eventually, and it can lead to opportunities that can result in money. So I think it's valuable in its own way. I would of course prefer cash, but you know, like, I don't like when people have this notion of like, oh, well, they're only getting paid in followers and attention, because it's like, those are valuable things. You can still, you know, wield those to promote your own things, or to kind of, you know, like, that's still a form of currency.
Didn't TikTok kind of wash that out, though? I mean, the whole thing around TikTok was just amplifying people as quickly as possible. And for the most part, most savvy creators caught on rather quickly that it was just this algorithm, like you say, which is perfect, but it seems to be perfectly aligned just to, like, the same way heroin is perfectly aligned to keep people coming back.
Yes.
And it just ends up, and then there's the questions about, like, and I would love to hear your opinion on this, like the U.S. government being able to quote unquote ban it, or, you know, having it just being able to taken away from you, or it being controlled by a Chinese government or something like that. That is why it seemed that no one took a TikToker seriously. It was almost like a whatever. And however, YouTuber has still kind of retained that, like you say, that gold standard.
Sure, but I mean, I remember when I first started covering YouTube and people would constantly say it was for cat videos and weirdos and people in their basement broadcast, you know, like it was considered, it was not cool to be a YouTuber in 2009. I mean, it wasn't, unfortunately. And I think with Gen Z, because those, that generation of kids has sort of grown up marinating in this culture, like they consider being a content creator aspirational, whereas it wasn't back because there was no money and it wasn't cool to, you know, it was required a lot of effort, you know, to be a YouTuber. It wasn't really what we have now. I talk a lot about this in my book, actually. And there's this whole chapter in my book about sort of the early days of YouTube and YouTubers. And I don't know if you guys remember Lonely Girl 15.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Well, when they were casting that boy to be in it, there was the main girl who's the main character and then her sort of sidekick, this guy. They didn't want to cast anyone attractive because they thought it wouldn't be believable that an attractive young man would be spending time on YouTube. Which is very funny because now it's just totally changed. So, you know, I think all these things are evolving and I think TikTokers are being taken more seriously. I think there are people who are developing more authority on TikTok. And I think newsrooms are definitely starting to take TikTok more seriously. I mean, the New York Times itself has launched a TikTok account, you know, other news outlets, NBC has a TikTok account. So they're trying to kind of operate in those spaces.
I was out visiting my parents last year, and they're in their 70s, late 70s, and they watched the local news station, which I haven't seen in like years. I haven't watched any of that. And it was kind of eye-opening on how many news stories are just TikToks that they're showing, and that's like the news report. It's crazy.
Yeah. It's so wild to me. I was getting a Google alert for the word TikTok for a while just to keep on top of like what was going on. And it was all just like you said, like local news stories repurposing content from the internet.
It's so lazy.
It's so lazy.
We just kind of throw words around. And that leads me to my next question. What would you actually define a content creator as?
Mm-hmm. I define it as anybody who's sort of creating content for one of these social platforms or blogging, creating content on the internet, basically, and then monetizing that content generally, but not always, but basically using the internet to create content and build a brand online.
And is that in an intentional sense? Mm-hmm. We're not talking about family member who posts a video that accidentally goes viral or are those content creators too?
I would not call someone like that a content creator because there's not that intentionality and consistency. I mean, of course, in the most generic, literal sense of the word, yes, they are creating content. But if you want to talk about this sort of specific type of role of content creator, influencer, whatever you want to call it, they used to be called celebrities, actually. I found all these funny words in my book of like what people tried to call content creators before the word creator took off, which, by the way, was in its modern usage only it wasn't until 2011 that YouTube started using the word creator. Before that, they called them partners. Content creators were called partners, which is why we have the YouTube partner program.
Sure.
That's how I define it. I don't think there's necessarily like a threshold of followers, but it's sort of somebody that's intentionally creating content regularly for the internet.
I kind of think a lot, at least in my experience, most of the YouTubers kind of think of themselves more as video creators rather than content creators. I don't know if a lot of YouTubers who kind of describe themselves as content creators, unless they're really focused on all platforms. But it seems to me most YouTubers are pretty much focused on YouTube.
Yeah, and I think the word creator has always been very synonymous with YouTube. And my book actually gets into all of this. But like the word creator, because it came from YouTube, for a long time, like Viners wouldn't call themselves creators because they were like, well, I'm a Viner. I'm not a YouTuber or I'm an Instagrammer or whatever. And it was this very platform specific language. It wasn't until Vine shut down and then you had suddenly people like, you know, Logan Paul or all these sort of this group of multi-platform creators in the 2010s that they couldn't be defined by one platform anymore. And so that's when you saw the rise of the word influencer take off because it was this platform agnostic language that could kind of speak to somebody gaining attention online. And of course, no one wanted to be called influencers. People prefer a content creator, which I totally get. It's
interesting that you talked about Vine because I think that probably was a turning point because the people came with an audience already established onto these other platforms, because it was like they didn't really have a choice. Well, I mean, of course they had a choice, but it was like, well, this is shutting down. You got to do something. So I think that's what gave rise to even a lot of the commentary channels, like Cody Ko and some of these guys came from that atmosphere.
Yeah. Yeah. I love Cody's videos. I mentioned in my book actually. He gave a lot of grief to a lot of Viners. Like, he did those cringe compilations.
Yeah, he walked that line of like the type of content which did so well for a while because it really resonated, and we're like, yeah, it's kind of a pleasant way to make fun of people. We're just critiquing them. Yeah. Or like, yeah, but that doesn't work anymore, does it? Or does it?
No, I don't think. I think that era has kind of passed because people woke up. I mean, it's like, it's fine if you're doing that to someone like Jake Paul. But I mean, I spoke to some of these female content creators that were featured on Cody's channels, and it really psychologically, you know, impacted them. And they were really upset and dealt with a lot of harassment from those videos that I think he actually didn't mean to be that way. You know, he meant to poke fun, but I think all those creators sort of suddenly realized, oh, there's actually some really bad downstream effects of this sort of like commentary. And he's evolved his channel so much since then. So,
well, I think that we see the same thing with like the old content cop videos.
Yes. And by the way, iDubbbz has had such a like arc. I mean, if you've seen him recently, like,
yeah, his like, he kind of had his like preemptive apology video.
And he was almost the last person I would expect to have such a genuine, authentic, reflective apology. And maybe not.
I thought it was so great that he did that. Like, I was really shocked by it. I actually would expect them not to do that. Like, I just wouldn't expect any person to take accountability for what they did ever.
Well, especially in that sense, it's usually very reactive, these things, and you're kind of, oh, I better come up with the apology video. But he kind of like, I got the sense he was thinking, I don't like looking at this old version of myself and the content I was making then, and I just need to address that. And for what I can tell, most people were totally on board with that.
100%, because I thought it was so earnest, and like you said, it wasn't reactive. It was really sort of like taking stock and being like, look, I've evolved. And people evolve. I mean, I'll give a little credit to Mr. Beast as well, which, I mean, hate to give credit to the biggest YouTuber of all time, but like, you know, I wrote a story years ago, right when he first started blowing up, that Mr. Beast fans got so angry about his homophobic comments. And he would use these homophobic slurs in his videos, and it made, you know, LGBTQ people were really upset by that. And then he stopped doing that, and now he's come out in support of his trans colleague. So, you know, it's good to grow up and evolve and, you know, recognize when you weren't maybe being
and
great.
So many of these people were so young when they started. Geez, you kind of have to give them a pass.
Your brains are not fully formed. But at the same time, I understand, you know, young people, like at the time of when I wrote about Mr. Beast, I think he was 21 or 22 when he was saying these slurs. And it's like, you know, LGBTQ people are also 21 and 22, and they know not to say, you know, it's like, I'm sympathetic to the fact that their brains are not fully developed. But I also think it's like, you should listen to the communities.
Where do you think Mr. Beast is heading? Just give me your crystal ball prediction here in like 5 or 10 years.
He said he wants to run for political office, and I think he could do it. I mean, he's got the fandom. It's kind of terrifying how virulently he idolizes Elon Musk. Mm. I think that's worrying.
I think further to our earlier conversation, a lot of people over the past decade have learned about having content in an archive or having content existing for a long period of time. And I remember when Leafy and Grade A, Under A, and all of these people during the first wave of commentary channels and whatnot, and I just thought to myself, like, this is such easy content to kind of make, and I should jump on it. But it just never kind of felt right. And I'm now 2020 hindsight, I'm like, great, I'm glad I never went through, did kind of one of those things, and now have to like explain. You delete your tweets, your older tweets, or you have a service which automatically after a while deletes your tweets. And one of your reasons is just for not having content without context, let's say. Could you talk about that?
Definitely. I think it's actually completely deranged to have an entire history of everything you've ever posted, like in a reverse cron timeline. It seems crazy. I'm a journalist, and I've been a public figure on the internet since you know, for over a decade. So my feeling is like, if I ever say anything controversial or newsworthy, it's screenshotted immediately and saved for posterity. So if it's newsworthy in the moment, like it's not like, and my tweets don't delete, you know, they delete after like a couple months. So it gives people time, you know, it's not like everything is that is relevant that I put on Twitter has been covered. But what I don't like is having this like long history. And actually it's so funny because PewDiePie made a video about me in, I think it was 2017 or 2018, chastising me for this. I think it might've been 2017. Anyway, and I went back to find that video because he was like, look, Taylor Lorenz deletes her tweets. And he archived a bunch of his old videos. So I thought that was very interesting because I was like, wow, here is this content creator that was, and his fans were, you know, he has a big fandom too, were like, oh, Taylor Lorenz. And now he himself is archiving his videos. I think it's, and I, as he should, no one should have anything because it gets taken out of context. It's not even that you said anything problematic. It's just that the context in which it was said has changed and it can be misinterpreted. And I think that's.
Look, I make woodworking videos and I've privated some of my earlier videos from 15 years ago.
If nothing else, it's because it's just you as a person have evolved and it's hard to rewatch yourself.
Yeah. What do you think about this whole concept of authenticity? It seems like this is like a buzzword these days. Everybody says you just have to be authentic, but see, I don't think that's really possible to be online and to be authentic. And I think people are trying to claim that they are, but kids today are growing up in a world where there's a video camera pointed at them all the time. And I guarantee that whenever that camera points to them, that smile goes on and that whole attitude changes and they go into performance mode. In one way or another, we're all performing.
I totally agree. And you're either performing authenticity or you're not performing authenticity.
That's what it really is, right?
Yeah. There's no like actual reality. It's just, I mean, it's just the nature of the internet. And it's true for the real world too, by the way. Like, you know, we're sort of these versions of ourselves in different environments. But it's just the nature of the internet. You're never going to be really, truly.
And I think we just grow up that way. Like the kids, I mean, you look at old home movies and whenever they like put a camera on kids, they never knew what to do. You know, they'd like maybe wave or look, act nervous. Now kids are like, bam, they're on.
Oh yeah. They're like, it's go time. I feel very bad. I've written a lot about children's privacy and how bad I think it is that we live in this culture where children are surveilled in such crazy ways. And I think it's great to have family photos and put those in an iCloud, you know, but I think it's to build a brand off your child is not, it's
100%.
Great.
Chad and I have talked about this ad nauseum on this podcast about family vlogging and about this whole idea of basically you're just monetizing your kids. They're working for free and they're not getting paid for it, so that they're not falling under any of these child labor laws. And we've seen them at these shows we've gone to where the parents will show this authentic shot of the kids, you know, walking into the room, and then they'll stop and they'll go, let's do that again. They have to reshoot. So I guess there's a bill floating around in Oregon, I don't know if that's still happening, about that it would give some rights to these kids to like be able to delete all of those old videos.
Washington State and Illinois have both pushed state legislation. It failed in Washington, but they're going to bring it back up next session. In Illinois, it went through, but they removed the privacy part of it. So they only kept the part that was like, oh, these kids should be compensated. But it's like the privacy thing is what's important. Like you should have a right to say, I don't want all these videos of my life on the internet. It's just, I understand the sentiment, which is that it's hard to regulate that. Like it's hard to, you know, we don't have a right to be forgotten and all these types of things that like they do in the EU and other countries.
Is that a right to be forgotten, or is it a right to, if somebody's making a video of you and posting it on their channel?
That's the name of the legislation in the, in the EU. It's called the right to be forgotten, which is basically like you can request that your results from Google are removed.
Oh, I see.
After a certain time, so the similar thing here would be like you could request, for instance, that your likeness is removed from this channel that was monetized. That's what people want. I think it's going to be very impossible to do that because if you open that door where suddenly you can have content taken down that includes you, you know, that's a free speech issue too. Like, so I don't know. It's tricky. I think I would love to live in a world where minors, you know, have more privacy and parents have more awareness and don't put their kids on the internet. But it's not just parents, it's schools, it's after school clubs. It's, we live in this world where everything is recorded, you know?
Right. And what are some solutions to that?
I think more comprehensive, that what we need to start with is more comprehensive data privacy legislation, which you mentioned the TikTok ban. Like, it's just such a farce and so disingenuous to say, oh, TikTok's harvesting our data, so we have to ban it, because look at what Facebook has done for 20 years. You know, like, look at these other companies. Like, if China wants our data, they can buy it from a third party Facebook broker, you know, like, so I think we need more privacy. You know, the number one thing that kids don't realize is just, and I did a story on this a couple of years ago where I interviewed dozens of children about the first time they Googled themselves and the amount of information. And so much vitriol gets put on parents and specifically mothers for saying, like, how dare you post pictures of your kid on the internet? Meanwhile, their school is, you know, running a Facebook page where they're posting photos of kids, or their, you know, sports team information can be found entirely online with the kid's birthday and sometimes even, you know, school district information. It just, like, it's so much worse than anything the mother is doing. So I think that we need privacy reform and legislation to fix these issues.
Do other platforms besides YouTube have the, are children in this video kind of checkbox?
No, actually, not that I'm aware of. I think TikTok might have filters that you can click, but I don't think so. I think it's just YouTube that has that. Are you talking about on upload, right?
Right.
I mean, yeah, I think it's only
YouTube. YouTube has the whole YouTube Kids kind of thing. They've obviously, they had to go head to head with all of those things for years now. Is there a particular platform right now which is doing a good job as far as privacy and these things are concerned? Or is everybody...
Their business model is like antithetical.
It's all shit.
Well, it's the business model. And until we get, you know, unfortunately, we have a bunch of regulators and people in Congress that don't even know how to turn their computers on. You know, like,
that's a huge problem.
Yeah. So I don't know that we're going to get any kind of real privacy reform.
And is it true that we're at the point where, like, in a society, we would much rather see a boxing match between Mark Zuckerberg and Elon Musk than them go to their respective platforms and be like, you know what, we're going to actually start implementing some changes here, and we're going to start addressing this, and we're going to be the, I guess it's a, wasn't Threads supposed to save us? Wasn't Threads supposed to save us all?
I like Threads. I'm a Threads defender. Like, I've been liking Threads a lot. Usage has definitely dropped off since the first week, but it just doesn't have all the same problems that Twitter has. Twitter is so, for even before Elon, it was incentivizing such negative interactions and toxicity. And, you know, Facebook's not great, but it's better than Twitter. Twitter's also just, since Elon came, it's so glitchy and depreciated. And
I mean, people have been bitching about Twitter for years now. It seems like nothing new about that. What is it about Threads that makes that possible, so it's not that way? Is it just a different algorithm?
Different algorithm, different. I mean, it's so stripped down right now. So there's no trending section. There's no search. There's no DMs right now. It's so bare bones. I'm sure as they add those features, things will get more messy. But for now,
more toxic.
Yeah, for now, it's great. It's like, I mean, there's toxicity for sure, but you can easily block people. You can really easily limit. I love that they rolled it out immediately where you can limit who you follow, and they imported all your block list over from Instagram. So everyone you blocked on Instagram is already blocked on Threads.
Oh,
I love that.
Is it fair to say that in 2016, when Donald Trump started going off about fake news, there was a shift there, that even though, like, we lived our lives online and we had a whatever, that to me, and maybe I'm just this weird paranoid guy, that really seemed to be the one moment that, like, everything got called into, like, everything became fair game almost. And, like, even the like fake news became like that. Just, it seems like we got our eyes open to it, and then all of a sudden we were like swimming in, like, in the deep end of it. Am I out to lunch on this, or are you shaking your head?
No, I think you're completely right. I totally agree with you. I covered the 2016 election, by the way, and was in the room the night that Trump won. And it was, I mean, this was a sort of core talking point of his campaign was don't trust the media, and you can't trust the media and you can't trust the mainstream news. And, you know, I am sympathetic to some of those arguments, but not the way that he's making them, because he's making that them against, like, it's like, yes, the media is incredibly fucked up and needs reform. However, he and other people sort of around him have made those arguments against legitimate, to sort of basically like get people to not trust legitimate reporting on him and critical reporting. And that's what that's what Elon Musk does.
So, and is that why I feel so uncomfortable about something that should have just been a business acquisition to turn it into a new, but they deliberately went after the most trusted source for journalists?
Well, that's Elon Musk's goal. I think Casey Newton wrote a really good piece recently. Casey Newton, by the way, runs this newsletter called Platformer, which is probably my favorite tech news outlet. And he wrote that this is a political project for Musk. Musk has long wanted to dismantle the journalism industry. That has been sort of a stated goal of his top funders, like, you know, Mark Andreessen and the Saudi government and stuff. You know, they all have these same interests, which is to elevate far right extremism and these anti-media narratives, and basically destroy people's trust in media institutions. And it's very self-serving. And that's his goal with Twitter. It's not to turn it into a profitable business.
But anyway, he's so brazen. Like, my point is, it's so brazen that we don't even seem to be, like, we are so numb because it's been almost 10 years since we've been so used to this weird roller coaster. He is doing it in real time. It took him 6 months to take something and everybody's like, whatever. And he smiled coyly at us and just funneled his, and it doesn't even matter if it was his money, because to your point, it's a whole bunch of other very, very strong interests. Just to see, like, the smirk on his face while he brazenly does it and still gets, like, slapped on the back and amplifies Andrew Tate and, like,
I know, it's so bad. And the media is so insanely inept at covering this stuff, unfortunately. It's like they're so flat-footed. I don't know if you saw that piece that was like, who's to say, you know, what, I think it was, I can't remember if it was in the New York Times or not, it was like, who's to say, you know, what Elon Musk's politics are? And it's like, he's saying it every day. What are you talking about? Go on his
Twitter
feed.
Retweets.
He's very overt.
Right. Yeah.
You know, like, he's very overt about his ideology, and it's bad. It's a bad situation that we're in. I do think that we're in this, like, in flux period where I hope we can come out of it and have a better system. I think the journalism and media industry, by the way, has been overly reliant on Twitter for way too long, and I do think that the platform just going away, in terms of that, it could encourage journalists to actually get out there on the internet and spend time in places that aren't just Twitter.
Do you think there'll be this resurgence in trust in mainstream media? And is that, I mean, ultimately, I guess it comes down to the question we were asking you, what it means to be a content creator, but how do you define a journalist?
Yeah, good question. And no, I don't think it's, I think that we're just losing trust in the media. This is, I get into this in my book, which is available now for pre-order. But, you know, I talk a lot about sort of this shift, and I think that we are certainly not gaining trust in the media. And I don't think the media has done much to deserve a gain in trust, just broadly. Yeah, in terms of how to define a journalist, I would say anybody that is doing reporting and publishing that reporting, whether it's in a podcast, a YouTube video, or a article, you are doing reporting in the sense that you are following journalistic ethical guidelines. You are interviewing people, you're putting together a story, and you're actually following journalistic ethics, I guess I would say. And that's a lot of people, right? It's not just people that work in full-time journalism. I think YouTubers, content creators can do journalism. Most of them don't. They could, but that requires things like understanding the concept of conflict of interest, understanding, you know, asking people for comment, or just like basic kind of like journalism things that a lot of commentators don't do.
It seems like we really want to jump onto some crackpot with an opinion and elevate that opinion over, and, you know, I guess you could say a lot about mainstream media, but we had JJ McCullough on last week, and he was, you know, his hot take is that this is really the best we have really, as far as journalism goes and as far as checks and balances go. Sure, it's got problems, but here's what we have.
I don't know if I agree that it's the best we have. I've seen, I mean, I work in traditional media. I think it's incredible. It's good. And I think there is a space for it. And I think that's the reason why I chose to work in this industry, is because I want it to like function the way it could. Unfortunately, right now we have a media landscape that's so fractured and so divided, and so many journalists who get into journalism simply because they themselves want to be close to power. And I think corporate media, you know, we don't have a viable alternative to corporate media in this country. So the mainstream, you know, sort of news organizations, yes, they're going to do some great investigative pieces. Yes, they're going to do great reporting on occasion, but they're also upholding a lot of corporate interests and corporate narratives. And I think that's bad. So I think we can build a much better system. But yeah, we need people to stop listening to all these randos that are truly not, you know, giving really bad, dumb opinions, but you know.
Yeah, I always feel like whenever somebody says, do your research, they're just wanting you to go to some crackpot website.
Yeah, that's like a big red flag. Because most people don't actually understand, I mean, this goes back to like basic journalism, like most people don't understand how to fact check something. They don't understand, they just believe everything they read. They don't have the understanding to sort of contextualize things. I mean, I wrote about a bunch about like sort of like anti-vax misinformation, and this is the classic thing. You see these people that are super anti-vax because they, you know, they are sort of like just believing disinformation, stuff that's easily debunked, but they don't understand that.
I live in the county in America that at one point had the least vaccinated people, and in a few years after COVID, it turned into the most vaccinated people. Marin County, California.
There
used to be a huge anti-vax movement here before COVID, and then once COVID hit, now it is all pro-vaccination.
Yeah, I think it's really sad, unfortunately, you know, with the anti-vaxxers, because you know, vaccines are drugs like everything else, right? And there's going to be side effects in a certain amount of people, and there's going to be these things, but we need to be able to engage with these people and not just dismiss it. I think a lot of it, I mean, I was in a sorority in college, and a lot of girls in my sorority have become very anti-vax, and I've talked to them about it. And it's just very like their media environment, their media diet's super fucked up. They're getting a lot of misinformation, but their concerns are very legitimate. You know, like they just have very legitimate questions that they actually do want answers for. It's just the only people that are speaking to them are conspiracy theorists.
Not getting this, because I think the science is there. There's information out there. I mean, the information is available. So is it just they are not getting that information, or they're choosing not to believe in this particular level of science?
I think they don't believe it because of the way the information is being presented to them. I think the information that the conspiracy theorists are presenting to them is presented in a far more compelling format and narrative than the other information, which is, by the way, a problem with conspiracy. I mean, conspiracy theories are always a little bit more compelling and interesting than the truth. Right. So I think it's hard.
But I mean, there were actually, you know, posts on Facebook saying that if you take the mRNA vaccine, you're going to die in 5 years. It's like 5 years. They were actually putting an actual date on this thing. You know, it's like that gets people excited.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's sensationalism.
And it's somebody in your Facebook feed posted it, so, you know, it's got to be real.
But the thing is, you hear it enough, and that's kind of the issue. And it isn't even just like these overwhelming conspiracy theories. It's the one story about the one tick, about the one person who had a tick on them for 24 hours, and they got a Lyme disease, and then they did whatever. And now there's news stories about, like, oh, did you hear about the person that got the, and then that other person heard that news story, and then they share about it. And it's one story, and it gets amplified so many times that my wife needs to check both me and my daughter thoroughly. You know, she doesn't, but you know what I'm getting at. Like where it...
Yeah. So much of this, though, I will say, especially with the anti-vax stuff, it's not a media problem. It's a healthcare problem. You know, if people had access to legitimate healthcare professionals, and if we had healthcare in this unit, you know, we don't, most millions and millions and millions of people don't have access to healthcare. Most of us don't have access to a regular doctor. Even if with the best insurance, like, you know, we're all in medical debt, it's like our healthcare system is failing. And that is, like, there's so many reasons, so many things that are fueling this anti-vax conspiracy, sort of health conspiracy movement. And so much of it is flourishing in America because we don't have access to legitimate healthcare. Many, you know, most Americans, because of our fucked up healthcare system that's tied to employment and insurance stuff. And like, you know, it's bad. There's in countries with better healthcare systems, you know, people, the health conspiracy problems are much better.
All right. So let's talk a minute about this upcoming book, Extremely Online. Here comes the softball question. So give me the overall premise of this book. And is it the title that we are all perpetually just online?
Yes. Yeah. It's about the rise of social media and how we all became very online and sort of how we have been taught to share ourselves and share every moment of our life, and how this industry of the content creator industry, influencer industry, whatever you want to call it, but basically this alternative media industry has emerged and become the dominant media industry in this country. And so it's about sort of like from the year 2000, the rise of blogging, mommy bloggers, to the earliest YouTubers, the first content house in 2009, you know, to Vine, to Snapchat, and just all these platforms, this live streaming boom, and kind of like how these platforms shaped culture and shaped, you know, how we interact with tech platforms, and also how this content creator industry became this $500 billion behemoth of an industry. Like, where did this, a lot of people feel like, oh my God, this just happened overnight. It didn't happen overnight. It's been happening for decades. And my book kind of charts that rise. So
that's interesting. You mentioned mommy bloggers. They were kind of key to all of this, huh?
They were truly the pioneers. I mean, they were the first group of people to truly monetize their personal brands on the internet. And the revenue pathways that they pioneered are, you know, still being used today.
And like your product is your content. And I'll get back to your earlier point of like when I asked about what is a content creator, and we've talked about the word information also, like how people access it. And it really does coming down to like people are interested in the monetary aspect of having you be the one that they get information from, hopefully the correct information. My question to you is, where do you go for your information?
All over. I mean, I mentioned like Casey Newton at Platformer. I love his newsletter. I get a lot of really good newsletters on Substack. I love Garbage Day, also another Substack newsletter. And then of course I read, I mean, the New York media, like New York Magazine, New York Times. I don't live in New York anymore, but as a New Yorker, I feel like a lot of like hometown loyalty to stuff like that. And then I just read, I follow a lot of people. I mean, I follow a lot of content creators. I spend an ungodly amount of time on YouTube and TikTok and Instagram. And so I get a lot of information.
Do you like making YouTube videos?
My God, I just started with the YouTube. Subscribe to my YouTube, everyone, because this is my year.
Smash that like button.
Smash
too.
The subscribe button. Yes, and I, you know, YouTube has always been the one platform that I have not really posted on, because I think I have so many friends that do YouTube and I just know how much work it is. And anyway, I was having a meeting with Simon & Schuster earlier this year and they were like, what's your YouTube? Like, you're on everything else. And I was like, it's weird that I am not on it. So, and now I have a YouTube and I do. I actually love it. I think
you will get that same Tumblr feeling out of YouTube, especially because YouTube's gone through the arc of like everybody trying to make their YouTube channels look like production companies and that. And now we're literally going back to like the days of YouTube. I can see it in the few videos that I watched on your channel. Like, it's such an interesting outlet for you because you're used to writing and or writing books or whatever. Is this your first book?
This is my first book.
Oh yes. My gosh. How was the writing process?
Congratulations.
It was hard. It's harder than I thought. I have newfound respect for every author because it's a slog.
How long did it take you?
It took me 2 years. I did it on top of my job, which I don't recommend. Oh.
But my wife wrote a book in 2017. She took like 6 dedicated months to do it. And like, it was the most draining. So I'm always fascinated with people who have gone through the book writing process.
I should have done that. I was doing it nights and weekends and burning out and yeah. But now that I'm done, this is what I'm saying. Now I have time for YouTube and I love talking to people and I love, I'm having so much fun. So yeah. I like video.
I think that's why people still run around into this day proudly, bro. Like, I'm a YouTuber. I'm a because it's how I love to be like, we're a content group, digital online media brand with producing. No, we're a YouTuber. Oh, yes. I know exactly what you do.
Yeah.
What would you tell somebody who was, so let's say somebody from 20 years ago all of a sudden was plopped down into today's media, social media landscape? What do you think would be like the biggest mind-blowing changes that they would be seeing?
Good question. I think they would lose their mind. You know that tweet of like 1 hour on the internet these days would like kill a 15th century peasant? Like, I think like one day on the internet for someone in 2000 would like break their brain because there's so much they'd have to catch up on. Yeah, I have a few offline people in my life, including my family members, and sometimes they send me things that are like, you know, 3 weeks old. Like, have you seen this? Like, this is crazy. And I'm like, that's not even that crazy. Like,
do you think more and more people, younger people, are going to start to separate their online life a little bit more?
I think young people have a much better understanding of privacy than a lot of people in my generation. I think millennials are like, it's almost the worst because you grew up in this actually quite safe internet where you could share and put, you know, 47 Facebook photos every night you went out, right? Like, and I think actually Gen Z has a better understanding of like privacy is really important and actually we don't want to put everything online.
Right.
It's hard though because these social platforms are pressuring you to share and you're rewarded for sharing and, you know, we all want validation.
Everybody just wants to post Barbie stuff.
That's yeah.
Chad, did you post any good Barbie content in this past weekend?
No, I have no idea how much Mattel's. Every single person was talking about that. Huh? Well done.
It was weird. There was like, was this like planned by Mattel to? Because people were not getting paid to post so much Barbie stuff, or maybe they were just like it was a tentpole event kind of a thing.
Yeah.
Is AI gonna just mess up everything?
I think it's transformative, but we're so early on. I mean, what people are scared of is still quite a while away. Like what, you know, like I tried to use ChatGPT actually to help me on EndNotes for my book. And like, it was like making up authors when the links didn't have author names on it. It was like giving me such wrong information.
It's very confident too.
Oh God. Yeah. And then you're like, that's not true. And it's like, oh yes, I'm so sorry. And it's like,
yeah, it apologizes.
What the hell? Okay. So then tell me the truth. I just think, I think it's a great creative tool. I mean, speaking of YouTube, I just found this great After Effects plugin that you could just run a script and it will automatically delete all the white space out of your video. Like I was like manually, you know, so things like that, I love. I think that's great. Or some of the, you know, AI creative tools, I'm all for. But I don't think it's like AI is at the point where it's going to replace a significant amount of creative work yet. Although I think that's smart for sort of the actors and people to be negotiating these things because we are very much at the beginning of the whole AI era.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of people don't understand. I was speaking last week on, I have another podcast, to an AI designer at Adobe. And she was telling me that I think the biggest misconception people have is that AI isn't really anything new. It's been around forever. Yeah. We've been using it. YouTube has been using their search results and their algorithm has been using AI for over a decade now. And it's only within the last 6 months because of ChatGPT and Midjourney that, you know, everybody's kind of like, oh, this is a brand new thing. It's going to take over the world. But it's still got, it's got a long ways to go.
Remember, we used to always talk about, oh, my phone. I'm pretty sure my phone's listening to me. Because it's like, it was the earliest forms of AI was doing very, it didn't need to listen to you.
I liked it where they trotted out all these AI robots in front of the UN. And it was weird. Did you see that, Taylor?
Yeah.
It's like this weird performative thing where they're like, are you all going to try to take over humanity? And they were just kind of giving these weird boilerplate answers. Like, no, we're here to serve man.
One of my favorite accounts on Twitter, I hope he brings it to other platforms, is called Pessimist's Archive. And I think it's called Pessimist Archive. Let me find. It's great. Hold on. I just want to make sure I got it right. Oh, yes. PessimistArchive.org. Actually, there's a whole website. I love this website. It's a newsletter. Great. And it has a Twitter account. They document all the hysterical tech panic over the years. And not just like computer stuff, but like they had this thing of like, you know, people saying like bicycles are going to destroy, you know, this and cause all these things. It just all the panic that's been happening over the years. It's funny. And when you go back and read it, you're like, oh, it didn't end up that way.
The radio also blamed for growth of ocean storms.
Yeah, exactly.
Good books called Answer to Comic Book Addiction. Oh, remember the comic book addiction of 1977? Steve?
Yeah. It's so funny. It's just, it's so, I love like going back and reading things like this because it just, it helps you sort of like when you read these AI type of things, it just helps you sort of be like, all right, you know, let's calm down a little bit.
Are we ultimately in need of a content creator union, or has this Hollywood strike kind of brought to the forefront a kind of like how AI is going to be and how corporations and how creators fit in? Is that going to like be the battle of what ends up on the other side of the next year or two?
Yeah, I just made a YouTube video about this topic, actually, talking about sort of this new sort of generation of content creators that also work in traditional Hollywood. There's a lot of, I think during the early days of the pandemic, a lot of, you know, actors that were out of work and TV writers that were out of work actually got on the internet and started seeing success online and sort of how that's shaped understandings of labor within the content creator industry. I absolutely think we need a labor movement from the creator world. I mean, it's very similar to the gig economy, right? We were sort of at the mercy of these tech platforms. And, you know, we've seen a big labor movement among gig economy workers too, that are sort of trying to take collective action against things like Uber and pressuring these platforms to serve their users better. And we need the same thing for the creator world. It's hard. And I think it's going to take a lot of effort. But again, this is a core theme of my book. And my book talks about all these times, actually, when creators themselves really reshaped the tech platforms that they use through their behavior or through sort of, you know, intentional pressure or through feature or relentless feature requests. So I think content creators have a very powerful collective voice. And it's really, it's labor to do this work. And
wasn't there there was an attempt at this a few years back? I think it was the Green Brothers and maybe Casey Neistat was involved in it. And it was like the YouTubers Guild, or I forget what they called it, but I don't know whatever happened to that.
Yeah, I mean, there's been, I know, and then there was the Creator Union and the TikTok Creator Union, and even the Instagram meme community tried to form a union. It's just, it needs to be a lot more widespread. And I think we need people that have experience or organizing to really get involved with that. Like, I think it can't just come from the creators themselves, although it has to come from big creators, but we need somebody that's like truly kind of in the, understands the business and understands what it would take to go up against these tech companies, which I talked to SAG, and this was in a piece that I wrote as well as my YouTube video. Like, I talked to a representative from SAG and they feel like, you know, look, we're Hollywood's biggest union already. We have experience negotiating against companies like Apple and Amazon, which are big tech companies. And so they feel like they could successfully kind of help influencers advocate for, you know, things as well. And you as a content creator can get healthcare through SAG if you meet certain requirements.
Would that be your biggest grievance, say, as a creator on YouTube, healthcare?
For me, yes. I'm extremely, unfortunately, very high risk with COVID. I have a lot of health problems. So like, I need healthcare. I'm not one of those like 24-year-olds. I was a 24-year-old without healthcare for a while, and it was bad. So I think healthcare is a huge, the fact that we don't have healthcare, I mean, it's a huge barrier to entrepreneurship generally in this country.
It's so expensive on your own. If you're not working for an employer, it's just ridiculous. It's
thousands of dollars a month. And the healthcare that you get is poor quality. So I talk to so many people that graduate business school, they want to do startups and they can't start their own company because the healthcare costs are too high. So it's really crazy and it's broken. And obviously we need a normal universal healthcare system like every other developed country in the world, but the insurance industry is very powerful in the US. So
yeah, it's gonna be a hard one to change.
Yeah.
Taylor, it was great talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. This was so fun.